Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Paul Clark, a member of the club's International Relations Forum and your chair for today's program. The program is Doctors Without Borders and the Necessity of Compromise with Sophie Delaunay, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA. Doctors Without Borders won the 1998 Nobel Peace Prize for pioneering humanitarian work, and has continued since then to find new ways to help those who face life or difficult situations by providing humanitarian assistance. But this sort of space they operate in, this humanitarian space, is also a negotiated space with powerful players in the places they work. So we ask ourselves today, in the changing context of our environment, is it getting more difficult to reach these compromises, and who decides what is an acceptable compromise when you're dealing with human life? And our speaker is going to explore the purposes and the ways and hows of how they conduct these negotiations, how the landscape that they work in is evolving since the end of the Cold War, the war on terror, and hopefully the post-war on terror era. And we're very fortunate to have our speaker. Her name is Sophie Delaunay. She's the Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA. And she's been involved with the organization for almost 20 years, very admirable. And she's worked on projects in Thailand, Rwanda, China, and Korea. And she's done evaluations of programs run by others in Liberia, Darfur, Central African Republic, and China. And she also had worked previously for a French agency that dealt with AIDS, and she ran 18 country programs. This is not an easy task. And she contributed to some publications, including a publication on North Korean asylum seekers, a fascinating topic. But you've heard enough of my voice, so let me ask you to help welcome our speaker to the podium here at Commonwealth Club.
Thank you very much, Paul, and thank you for inviting me to address today. It's really a privilege, a honor, a pleasure to be able to present at the prestigious Commonwealth Club. So Paul explained that I'm going to try to share with you some of the perspectives surrounding humanitarian space and the negotiations in accessing difficult areas and populations in need. As we speak now, there might be several hundred organizations trying to make their way into Syria, either by negotiating access, getting authorization from the Syrian authorities, either by trying to identify some clandestine networks in order to cross the border into Syria and provide help to the population in need, or by trying to help Syrian communities who manage to cross the border into a foreign country and seek assistance. And MSF is part of these hundreds of organizations trying to provide some medical care to the Syrian population. And the Syrian example just illustrates the permanent, constant issue surrounding access. So surrounding access and the notion of humanitarian space. In recent years, there's been a growing concern among aid organizations over the possible loss of humanitarian space, something that we've called the shrinking of the humanitarian space. And this notion, this shrinking of space, was for most part attributed to what we also call the blurring of the lines, whereby true humanitarian, and I say true humanitarian actors, could no longer distinguish themselves from belligerents and from other actors whose intentions were not necessarily humanitarian. So this blurring of the lines resulted in less respect and less faith for the neutrality, the impartiality, and the independence of humanitarian action, and led to a series of very serious security incidents, to limited access to danger zones and to populations in need, and resulted in a reduced ability to assess and operate independently on the ground. And certainly, Afghanistan in recent years is the country that illustrates the best this blurring of the line. When Colin Powell called NGOs force multipliers, he infuriated the whole aid community, but he was actually describing a reality. At that time in Afghanistan, there were clear, the lines were completely blurred between the coalition, the military intervention, between the NGO community who tried to coordinate with the military and was clearly part of the peace resolution effort, with armed forces involved in reconstruction and aid to the population with a view to win hearts and minds of the communities. And this resulted into in a very clear loss of space for humanitarian action, loss of access for part half of the country, because most of the aid was concentrated in areas that were under the control of the ISAF forces. So it took us almost 1 year to actually carve our space in Afghanistan, negotiate our ability to work there, and ensure that the health facilities where we would work would be respected and would not be targeted. So this being said, even though we managed to reestablish medical care in Afghanistan in several hospitals, we did share at that time the notion of shrinking of humanitarian space. It was not just the rest of the aid community. MSF also was very concerned about this trend, especially because this period coincided with a series of dramatic reduction of our own space of action. In 2009, we were expelled from Niger right before the presidential election because President Tanja considered, maybe rightly so, that we were giving too much visibility to child malnutrition. The same year, after President Bashir was indicted by the criminal court, the French section and the Dutch section of MSF, Doctors Without Borders, were expelled from Darfur. And these same years, we also faced very serious limitations in Sri Lanka and in Somalia, and also in Yemen. So we were ourselves affected by this shrinking of humanitarian space. But at the same time, it was difficult to reconcile this assumption with the fact that there's never been so many aid actors on the ground, there's never been so many resources allocated to humanitarian action and to global health, and so we had a hard time to reconcile these two notions, especially because MSF was no exception to the rule. We had become a $1 billion organization. As we speak, we have 27,000 colleagues operating in 80 countries, providing assistance there. Last year, we conducted more than 8 million consultations. We delivered 150,000 babies. We did millions of vaccinations. So there is a sort of incongruity in stating that the space is shrinking when you actually have observed continued growth in your operations. And this is why we decided to have a retrospective look at our operations in the recent years, and to examine how the negotiations had been conducted. So we looked at the countries where we face the greatest challenges in terms of access: Myanmar, Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, South Africa, Yemen, Ethiopia, Nigeria, and we try to review the negotiating process in each of these countries and try to understand what had made MSF accept or not some degrees of compromises. And what was interesting, including for us within the organization, was that this review clearly demonstrated that there was no predefined space, humanitarian space, that we could actually claim as a right, and that we could, in virtue of being a true humanitarian workers. No, instead there was this space of work varies depending on the countries, depending on the context, and this is a space that needs to be negotiated constantly and gained and conquered. And another finding that we made in this review was that in every single situation, we had to accept some degree of compromises. So these compromises could take different forms, but mainly three forms. One would be to accept limited access. Myanmar is a good example. For 20 years, we've conducted intense medical diplomacy in Myanmar, and mostly to be able to treat HIV patients. But at the same time, we've also had to accept that there were areas where we knew there were tremendous medical needs that we've never been able to access. So Myanmar is really a challenging country in that regard, not only by the fact that we can't access all the territory and address all the medical needs, but also because in our HIV programs alone, we are limited in the number of staff we are able to bring into the country, which de facto limits our own ability to treat the people, the patients, because there aren't enough skilled staff in Myanmar to support our effort. So we have to make, I let you imagine how difficult it is for the team to do some triage and to decide who they're going to treat and who they're not going to treat, knowing that they don't have enough capacity to do so, just due to visa problem, basically. Pakistan is also a good example of how we've had to accept limited access to some areas. In Pakistan, we've successfully managed to operate in northern provinces, in tribal areas, in the Fatah regions. We've also been allowed to, which is quite remarkable actually, to work in Baluchistan, in some parts of Baluchistan, but we've never, ever, ever been able to work in Waziristan, where, as you know, there is intense fighting. And so it's always a balancing act for us. We're still able to do things in Pakistan, but having to compromise on some other areas. Another form that the compromises we've made has taken was to ensure limited visibility. And this is something that we had to experience in several countries where the country tolerate your presence, but they don't want you to make waves, basically. India is certainly a very interesting example for us because at the time we were working in Bihar province in India, we were trying to introduce ready-to-use therapeutic food. And there were much resistance to do so. But the compromise that we managed, which was also a compromise from their side, and it's important to know that, is that we were able to operate provided that we would keep a very low profile in our program, which didn't mean that we didn't, as some of you may know, we've been extremely active in the advocacy against childhood malnutrition. So abroad, we were able to continue advocate and learning from our experience in India to advocate for better quality food aid and for a proper treatment for childhood malnutrition. A third form of compromises that we've observed in these countries where we work was, and it's certainly the most painful one, is when we have to commit to remain silent. You know that MSF was born out of this outrage from these journalists and doctors experiencing the Biafra crisis and deciding to combine from the very beginning témoignage, bearing witness, with the medical action. Well, as a matter of fact, in some circumstances, we've had to sacrifice one or another. And Sri Lanka in recent years is certainly a good illustration of this dilemma. in 2009 when the Sri Lankan military launched the last offensive against the Tamil Tigers. This resulted into very, very violent bombings, and MSF, but when I say Doctors Without Borders or Médecins Sans Frontières or MSF, of course I'm talking about the same organization. So MSF was present there, and we were able to receive a very large number of patients with extremely severe wounds, which clearly demonstrated the indiscriminate nature and the violence of the bombings, because we're also receiving a very large number of civilians. So at that time, the teams were shared between the willingness to express the outrage, to speak out, to denounce this violence, which was against the, you know, most basic rules of war, and at the same time, it was made clear by the Sri Lankan government that should we speak out, we would also have to leave the country right away. And at that time, we made the decision, we thought that we would be we would have a greater impact for the population by staying and by providing assistance, especially surgical assistance, given that there was no other operators on the ground and there was no available, these type of services were not available. So these are the analysis we made and the finding we got from this research. One interesting point for me is that it certainly shows that we've had to negotiate in every single country, we've had to make compromise every time, but these compromise and these negotiations do not always involve just Doctors Without Borders and the military or the governments. Actually, we've had more and more to put the civil society in the equation. It's the case of South Africa. It's the case of India. We've had to convince the emerging civil society that our course of action was acceptable, which is a very interesting development in the humanitarian field. One persistent pattern, however, even though each case are different, was that compromise, in every single circumstances, compromise was driven by the expected benefit for the patients. And if our presence would involve maximal medical benefits, then we would be more inclined to compromise. Whereas if our presence had no life-saving impact, then the threshold was much, much higher. So in the end, one principle that we realized we could never compromise in any circumstances is our independence of judgment, because only with the independence of judgment you can actually keep the ability to decide where is this red line that we see. And there are red lines. There are certainly some. We've experienced them in many circumstances. Recently, when we decided to leave, to close our program in Libya, that was clearly a red line that we put ourselves with our own independent judgment. We've been operating in Libya during the war, and after the fall of the Gaddafi regime, we continued to provide assistance, and we were able to work in detention centers in Misrata. After some months working in these detention centers and providing medical assistance to the detainees, we realized that some detainees were victims of torture, and that we were actually treating them for torture, and that some of them were treated only to be sent back to torture. So we were getting instrumental in this torture system, which led to the decision to, after lots of negotiations, after trying to convince the authorities to stop these practices unsuccessfully, we decided to leave to close these programs. So this is to say that if we didn't have our independence of judgment, we wouldn't be able to decide ourselves within the organization that this is where we want to put the red line. And this independence certainly is facilitated and has been facilitated over the years by the financial independence that we have created by deciding not to rely on government funding and to be able to rely on the diversity of the private funding. Because only when you are relying on private funding are you able to guarantee that your decisions are made on base on needs only, and that you're not under any kind of pressure to fulfill a security or a strategic agenda of a specific country. So this analysis was collected and detailed in a book, Humanitarian Negotiation Revealed, the Experience of Médecins Sans Frontières, that is available tonight, and you can get the book after the session, and I'd be happy, although I'm not an author of this book, it was produced by a group of researchers who work for Médecins Sans Frontières. I'm happy to put a note to it. So this book is interesting for MSF because it has triggered some discussions internally, and certainly it has elevated the understanding of we ourselves in the organization have about our own practices. But it's not a recipe book about how we should conduct negotiations, certainly not. And it's not a recipe book about how MSF is doing negotiations. Actually, there is MSF's acceptance or resistance to compromise has not been linear at all over time. It's quite the opposite. In the 80s, during the Cold War, we were actually quite a human rights organizations. We protested against totalitarian regimes in Cambodia, in Ethiopia. We also try to highlight and denounce the perverse effects of aid. We even withdrew from Ethiopia at that time. In the 90s, we took position in the political debate. It was no longer human right. It was we are acknowledging that we were a political actor in the whole scene. And we went as far as calling for military intervention in Rwanda, soon to realize that the remedy can also be harmful for the population. It was also the decade when MSF made clear and very drastic choices, where we clearly demonstrated that we had an idea where this red line was. We decided to withdraw from Goma camps in Zaire based on the assumption that these camps were totally under the control of the Interahamwe, the militias that had been responsible for the genocide and that were just using aid to rearm themselves to retaliate. We also made the choice of withdrawing from North Korea because we had understood that the aid was just perpetuating a system that was itself starving its own population. So these were very difficult choices. We made them. We still don't know if this was the right choice, but they reflected the mentality, the spirit, and the philosophy of the organization at that time. And then, after all this very painful experience, in the year 2000, the organization actually, when you look at how we reacted, it's clear that we reaffirmed our neutrality in the conflict. We took a clear distance from international justice. We clearly expressed our skepticism about NGOs' intervention or NGOs calling for military intervention. I don't know if some of you are familiar with the R2P, the Responsibility to Protect, which is a doctrine about protection of civilians. And we clearly stated that we thought it was not NGOs' role to actually call for this kind of intervention because of the collateral damage and the violence and the lack of neutrality that this kind of intervention convey. So you see, it hasn't been linear at all, and it has translated into a much more pragmatic and an independent, impartial approach on the part of the organization. What is sure, however, is that this natural tension between accessing beneficiaries and speaking out, and this tension about the political roots of the crisis, it does remain, and it will always do. There will always be. It's in our DNA. Anyway, we made this this choice at the beginning, and it's going to be a permanent contradiction. But our response and our approach to this tension has evolved again, and it will continue to do so. In 1999, you mentioned, Paul, that when we received the Nobel Peace Prize, and we decided to use this prize to raise our concerns over the bombing in Grozny, Chechnya. And the president, MSF president at that time, James Obinsky, when he was referring to the bombing on Grozny in his speech, he said, "We are not certain that by speaking we will be able to save lives, but we know for sure that silence kills." So it was a very strong statement by the organization reaffirming the dominance of speaking out over, not necessarily over operating, but really they had the same value, and we don't want to sacrifice this principle. Well, if you read this book, Humanitarian Negotiations Revealed, you will see that there is one chapter written by Fabrice Westman, one of our researchers, who entitled Silence Can Heal. And he tries to demonstrate that actually in recent years, when we've made the choice of not speaking out, we've saved more people, Sri Lanka being one of the examples. So it's to say that, in fact, we have a tendency now to balance témoignage with action with a bit more pragmatism than in the past. So I'm coming to the end of my speech, and I hope I'm on time. And I hope that I was able to convey our own understanding of this humanitarian space, a space that for us is not a predefined, intangible right of intervention that we can claim just because we are humanitarian actors, but a space that is a perimeter of work that can vary depending on the context, depending on the organization itself, our principles, our aspirations, depending on the interests of the other parties we are dealing with. And this is a space that is not a given, but that we have to constantly work on when we try to reach the populations in need. But more importantly, I hope that through this reflection over the humanitarian space, I was able to break or burst some preconceived ideas about the heroic nature of humanitarian aid. We're certainly not, aid workers are not heroes. The aid system is not black and white. They are not good humanitarians and bad ones. It's a very, very complex environment. It's politically charged, and aid workers and aid organizations are parties to the political dynamic of the crisis. They have their own distinct interests. They have their own values. But they have no other choice than to mutually recognize these different interests if they want to coexist in the same environment. So thank you, and I will welcome your question.
Thank you, Sophie. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Sophie Delaunay speak on the challenges of doing humanitarian work in inhospitable places. And we'll now take questions from the audience. This is being recorded for a podcast, so please use your microphone that Karen is passing around. Thank you.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I have sort of a two-part question. Would you say that since the beginning of MSF's work, the people that you deal with in a country have changed to be a little less the government of the country and more rebel organizations, if that's the right phrase? And I guess the other part of that is, if that is so, how much of that affects the safety zone and the difficulty of negotiations versus how much MSF may have changed itself?
That's a very difficult question. Well, I don't think that when I said we are also dealing with the civil society, I didn't mean that we used to deal with governments and we're no longer doing so. It's actually a bit the opposite, because in the past we were more often working in failed states. You know, we've been doing a lot of cross-border in the past. We're still doing a little bit, but whenever we can get a visa, we try to apply for the visa first, right? Which was not necessarily the case in some previous crisis. When you think of Liberia, for 15 years, this country has been at war. There was no Ministry of Health in Liberia at the time, right? So, and the current Health Minister of Liberia likes to say that MSF was the Ministry of Health at that time. So this is to say that we are actually dealing more and more with governments in just every single country. And when we cannot have access, it's because the governments don't let us access some areas. And so we try other means. In the meantime, we're also dealing a lot with militants, with groups, with other communities. And you're right to say that actually with the fragmentation of conflicts, but Paul is an expert in this area, it's clear that in some countries we have to deal with more and more different groups, which poses another challenge to MSF. It's, you know, how many resources, how many skills do you have in an organization to be able to read the landscape and to understand with whom to negotiate and how to identify the different interlocutors. So in doing so, being close to the communities and trying to rely as much as possible on our national staff is extremely helpful. What I meant by we are dealing more and more with civil society, I think it's a very good sign. It's just because in some countries, the civil society is able to play a significant role. And so we have to acknowledge these changes and we have to enter them in the equation. It's going to be the same for the Middle East. We are discovering this environment to some extent because we are not working there, but we realize that there are lots of local NGOs who want to help their communities, who have lots of means, lots of skills, and we're going to have to learn operating with them, and you know, we're going to have to create our own space within this environment.
Could you please elaborate a little on a chaotic event like the earthquake in Haiti? Who do you deal with, and to know where to go and whom to help amongst all the other people that are coming to help? Mm-hmm.
So Haiti was an exceptional event. So I will talk about Haiti anyway. We were in Haiti when the earthquake hit the island. So what we did, and we were already conducting some surgical programs. We had stocks, we had generators, we had the right skills on the ground, which was quite exceptional, right? And so we were able in the following hours to start treating patients who were showing up to our office. Our hospital, one of our hospital, collapsed. And in the meantime, yes, we were trying, of course, to coordinate with local authorities, although in Haiti, in the first few, the state collapsed as well as the legitimate coordination body, the UN. They lost a great deal of the heads. They were completely decimated during the earthquake. So for us, the priority was certainly not coordination. We couldn't even coordinate between our teams. We had three programs in Port-au-Prince, and they could not call each other. The roads were blocked, as you know, and the lines were not working. So it's actually from New York that we were coordinating them. We're telling them, okay, we got news from the other team, they are moving there, they're doing this, what are you doing, etc. So it was a big challenge. And then it took days for the United Nations to find the space and the resources to organize, you know, find a room, organize a meeting to coordinate the, I think there were 250 NGOs who just, it was a tsunami of NGOs in Haiti. And so what we did was we organized our own coordination system with Save the Children, Oxfam, I think there was Action Contre la Faim, And we gathered in our office and we say, okay, which part are you taking? We knew anyway that we would cover maybe 60-70% of the needs because we're the largest organizations on the ground, and this is how we coordinated ourselves in the first days of the catastrophe.
Sophie, I have a question. With the death of Ambassador Stevens in Libya, are you able to stay out of dangerous areas like Libya, Pakistan, Afghanistan?
To stay out?
Yes, because it's too dangerous.
Well, we don't want to stay out. We want to be there. Well, in Libya, as I said, the reason for us for downscaling our programs in Libya is not that it is a dangerous zone. It's because we close our programs because of the detention, the torture in the detention center. But we're still exploring ways to support the health system in Libya. We've been doing some mental health activities. A lot of people, you imagine, have been completely traumatized by the event, and they have a hard time to get back on their feet. We've also supported some African communities displaced in Tripoli. And we continue to explore some needs. So yes, security is an issue, of course. If it was completely stable, it would be easier to do our assessments and to conduct our negotiations. But the very reason for us to be there, it's because it's not that we want to be in dangerous places, it's because we know there are less actors and there are more needs in these places. And so we are trying constantly to balance the risks between that. We have drastic security measures. We are surrounding ourselves with very good and skilled staff who know how to measure the dangers, who know how to liaise with the community. And as I said earlier, we rely very much on our national staff because they are the ones, and imagine, they take responsibility for our security. So most of the times they are the one who are the best source of information, and they are the best to negotiate as well with the community.
Did winning the Nobel Prize have an effect on access to countries, and did it have an effect on donations, and where do most of your donations come from?
So access and then donations. You know, I'm going to tell you a story I experienced myself when we received the Nobel Peace Prize, and my old friend Christine, who is at the back of the door, was my translator in China at that time, knows about it. The day we received the Nobel Peace Prize, I was head of mission in China. And for months, we've been, you know, negotiating with the Chinese officials. There were some Chinese officials who were really eager to help us and to have MSF set up a program. And there were others who were not so keen having this foreign organization putting their nose in their business, right? And potentially denouncing the quality or low quality of the health system. But the day we received the Nobel Peace Prize, of course, it was all over the media. And in Beijing, I just received a few phone calls from the Chinese media. Most of the phone calls were from Chinese officials calling me and saying, "Have you seen? We've won the Nobel Peace Prize." And so this was a good example of how this could open doors and bring legitimacy to the organization. And it's true that we've been in a honeymoon for the following 3 months with our Chinese partners. It's been very helpful. Of course, it's not the panacea, you know, but it has tremendously helped MSF in gaining notoriety is a positive word. So, in being known abroad and giving visibility. Now the donations, yes, certainly, but surprisingly, I don't think it's the Nobel Peace Prize who contributed so massively to our growth. It's mostly the emergencies, because every time we are confronted with a major emergency, we realize that it also contributes to a massive growth of the organization. Because we intervene, then we get more support from the population, and from there we get more recognition. So, does it answer your question?
Hi. Hi. You had mentioned, I think it was in Liberia, that they said that you kind of acted as the health ministry for a while. So I'm just curious, how do you end up transferring that back to the country that you're in, particularly in very conflict, you know, places with really high security?
That's a very good question, and it gives me another opportunity to deconstruct a myth about MSF being an emergency organization and not leaving any sustainable impact in the countries. Actually, in Liberia, I think we were very bad in closing some projects. There is one project I think we closed in 24 hours. Mamba Point Hospital in Monrovia. We referred the patients, the last patients, to GFK Hospital, and then we closed the program. It was very brutal. Other projects in Monrovia, we based on this lesson, we actually spent 2-3 years making sure that we could hand over some components of the programs to the Ministry of Health. So this varies. This is a concern we have. We know we're not so good at it, but we're really working at it. And you know, the problem is to find organizations to hand over or to find ministries who are able to keep the program at the same level, same quality as when it was. Our budget in Liberia was equivalent to the budget of the Ministry of Health. So it's a challenge for them to just take over our activity, right? This being said, I mentioned at the beginning that we have 27,000 staff on the ground. Only less than 10% of these staff are international staff. The rest is national. They are trained. And so this is our footprint. We train a lot of people who are then allowed to exert medicine and do their practice within their communities. In Liberia, when Ellen Johnson Sirleaf came to power, she decided to put great emphasis on the health services. And they established a system by which they would send a large number of doctors all throughout the country with a very significant pay, salary. At that time, I think they decided to pay $800 a month for each doctor, which is very, very high compared to the local standards, the regional standards. And all MSF staff were hired, all of them, because of their legal, their skills. So in my view, this is how we actually give back to the community and ensure that they're going to be able to perpetuate the knowledge that they've acquired.
Thank you for asking that question. That was my same question almost. but building off of that a little bit, thinking about this humanitarian space and working in resource-limited settings, do you ever feel pressure to perform or to not perform certain treatments because you may create a vacuum of care in which patients will not be able to have adequate follow-up after MSF leaves, depending on your ability to leave and your ability to shut down those programs and transfer them well?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm not a doctor, so unfortunately I can give you some very concrete examples, but any doctor who would respond to this question would be able to give you daily examples of how they have to make choices, knowing that the person might not be able to continue the treatment, right? But the dilemma is not so much about treating or not treating. We are treating. We consider that if we have access to the drugs and the medicine and if there is a way to treat precisely, this is why we're here. We're here to fight the neglect. We're here to fight the double standard. We're here to make sure that if there is available medicine, then people can have access to it. And we've also decided to challenge this paradigm in the 2000 when we decided to introduce HIV treatment in our program, knowing that it was a lifelong treatment and it's still a lifelong treatment. So we know that we might be expelled from the country or we might have to leave a country and that there's no 100% guarantee that these people will be able to continue their ART treatment, but we made the commitment ourselves to stay for as long as possible and to make sure that the Ministry of Health is able to take over this kind of responsibility. For example, that's why for HIV, I don't think there is any example of MSF programs being disconnected from the Ministry of Health. We try to integrate our program in the national program to ensure this continuity.
First, I'd like to congratulate you and thank you, actually, for your many years of work with such an important humanitarian organization. I wanted to bring up your example of East Timor, actually, and as you described it, I can only imagine how difficult that decision was, where you have ongoing bombing and you're treating victims, and yet your silence may be contributing to the ongoing bombing. And I was wondering, your earlier example of, say, the blurred lines of NGOs and that sort of thing, it was remarkable to me that there was that level of silence, if you will, between NGOs when something like that is going on. Is there perhaps any opportunity for intercommunication where some other organization that is very humanitarianly active in on that end of things would in some way be kind of playing a role on the other end of things?
You know, yes, you're right. There is no... there is not a large public debates between NGOs about this, but there is clearly there are discussions among NGOs. We try not. There is a sort of ethics of work between NGOs, and we try not. Although MSF is already an organization that tends to denounce and speak out a lot, the point for us is not to point at some NGOs about what they do, but really to bring our own perspective and to try to protect our own space of action. So these discussions are happening. The reason for us to launch this book was and to compile this information was precisely to trigger this kind of debate with NGOs. I must say that I've been a little bit disappointed. We've organized a few panel discussions in the U.S. We've invited some NGOs, but the partners who came were, most of the time, they did agree with us. So it was not really a debate, and we've not been successful in really entering into a critical exercise between with our peers. And I think we need to continue work on that. Okay. Sorry, I didn't.
Hi. You made reference to true, quote, humanitarian organizations and NGOs like that. And so I was wondering what sort of... consequence have ostensible humanitarian organizations had on true, non-quote, humanitarian organizations? And has that jeopardized the work of MSF?
Yes, of course. And but I put on quote because I don't think there are true humanitarian organizations versus non-true or ostensible, as you say. But it's true that... the different nature, the different mandate of organizations, when they all claim to be humanitarian, create some confusion, misperception, and depending on which side, especially if they are not impartial. And so if they decide to work on one side but claim that they are humanitarian at the same time, this does create a loss of credibility for the whole humanitarian community. So this is what we've experienced. And there are many examples of multi-mandate organizations, as you know, who are both working on development, emergencies, but development implies that you have to collaborate, you have to support a peace resolution process, you have to therefore accept to be on one side, right? And this was the problem of Afghanistan. Even the UN sided to the Western forces, because it was all part of this very legitimate democratic exercise toward Afghanistan. But it had the impact of isolating part of the population and part of the country from the reception of assistance. So for us, the reason why we are also a little bit more cautious in denouncing this and claiming that we are true and other are not true humanitarians is that we're also perfectly aware that it's easier for us as a medical organization to implement the principles of impartiality, because they are very much alike the medical ethics. And it's much more difficult when you are a development organization to be completely impartial. And so we acknowledge that. We recognize this tension. But this being said, we still have a big... And I maybe Paul can add a few comments, but with the military or occupying forces, they have a responsibility, according to the Geneva Conventions, to provide some assistance to the population who are in the area that they are based. So it's not that they're not supposed to give aid, is that the fact that this same rhetoric is used by everybody, we are humanitarian and at the same time we are a combatant, is very harmful to the notion of what humanitarian is. So the solution for us, just as we said, humanitarian space is not a space you can only claim, you have to work on it. We also think that humanitarian action is not a concept or a principle that you can just claim. It's something that needs to be translated into action, and you will be judged by your acts. So if you're providing medical assistance, and only if you say you're a medical actor, if you say you're impartial, then you need to only do medical assistance, and you need to demonstrate you're impartial by working on all sides of the conflict. So this is how we've managed ourselves to resolve this challenge, but it's made easier by the fact that we are only focusing on the medical.
I'm curious to hear more about your experience working or doing capacity building work in China, and specifically what are some of the best practices or strategies that you've identified in terms of negotiating with the government, and how you see your organization's work evolve in the country over time.
We've had successes and failures in China. I will start with the failures, maybe. We tried for many, many years to strengthen the health system in an area of China. The idea for us, of course, was not to address the whole health system, but to try to do a sort of pilot project and demonstrate that it was possible to actually upgrade the quality of care in very remote places in China. So at that time, it was in Guangxi province, and our coverage, our area of operations was village, township, and not county, but village and township, which covered a large proportion of the population, but very isolated, extremely poor, and with very limited medical skills in the area. So we worked for, I think the program lasted more than 6 years, trying to train traditional birth attendants to deliver women at home, trying to train village doctors who were the initial barefoot doctors to deliver, you know, basic care, trying to develop reference hospital at township level. We worked on two hospitals. After 6 years, we closed the program. It was not successful. We didn't manage. And we didn't have the recipe for success. So I must say that the health reform that has been launched by China has been certainly much more successful than what we've ever done in Guangxi province. Then we've had a very successful program on HIV/AIDS. It was in the year 2000. Actually, it was a three-year negotiations. I conducted this negotiation, so I remember it well, trying to convince the Chinese authorities that there was an HIV problem in China, because it was complete denial, and that that this problem, once acknowledged, couldn't be treated by criminalizing or stigmatizing the population, but by providing treatment. And because we had established this good relationship following the Nobel Peace Prize with our partners from Guangxi province, and after also, I think that the point that triggered the opening of the Chinese authorities was when we organized a round of the hospitals in France, and they met with all the doctors who had faced the epidemic firsthand at the beginning of the 80s, and who shared with the Chinese doctors and officials all the mistakes that we had made in dealing with the HIV outbreaks. And after this visit, they were convinced that, you know, there might be something to do about it, and they opened the door. We had this program for almost 2 years. It closed last year. but this was the first HIV treatment program in China. It's been handed over to the Ministry of Health, and it's being continued at the moment. So it was a successful experience.
And so you have the last question.
So it's it's difficult to ask theoretical questions when it comes to people's lives, but when you're chosen, when your decisions have caused you to choose silence over speaking out, to what extent do you feel like you're treating the symptom rather than the cause?
In most humanitarian crises we are responding, we are perfectly aware that the causes are political causes. They're not medical ones. So we are always treating, you know, the symptoms to some extent. What we want is to inject a space of dignity and humanity in an environment where there's no more humanity and ability for the people to be restored in their capacity of choice. So you're right, we are... We certainly did not address the Sri Lankan issue is a very complex one. We were divided in the organization, clearly. The decision was made, but there is still strong disagreement over this decision. And second, the reason why this decision was made was that the violence of the last offensive was actually denounced by ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross. So this was really what convinced MSF not to go for it, because it wouldn't have any added value. It was already claimed, and there was already an investigation launched by the UN to look at the situation.
I want to give our thanks to Sophie Delaunay and the workers of the Doctors Without Borders, and thank you for your comments tonight.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, everybody.
That was really engaging, and I know we'd like to go on another half an hour. But I also want to thank our sponsors. We are sponsored by the NorCal Peace Corps Association, brought to us by the talented Karen Kiefer, who volunteered today. I want to acknowledge also the leadership of the International Relations Forum, Norma Walden and Linda Calhoun. I also want to acknowledge the UN Association, which has co-sponsored, and the Truman National Security Institute. And you, our audience, thank you for coming. Without you, we would have no reason to be here. Thank you. And now this meeting is adjourned.